the Back in Time podcast. I'm your host, Kyle Autry, joined as always by my co-host, JD. JD, we're fresh off a party. We're licking our wounds a little bit here. How are things tonight?
Things tonight are a whole lot better than they were yesterday. I really don't know what happened to any of my time on Sunday because I just laid on the couch and watched TV.
That's awesome. Yeah, I really did the same thing. I think I got home 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and then I stayed up till 10, and I did not move from the couch from 3 to 10. Just
that's the way to do it.
Out. So fun times, though. Yeah, we'll definitely talk about that. We're either going to put out an episode that you guys can listen to us live at the party. Unfortunately, there's some audio stuff we're trying to work through. If we don't do that, then we'll do like we'll definitely put out like a Halloween episode of me and you talking, you know, sharing some stories and bringing some things down that way. But before we dive into today's episode, Friday the 13th part 2, I want to thank you guys for hitting the download button on the podcast today. You can subscribe for free on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, CastBox, IGTV, and YouTube. You can follow us on social media at Back in Time Pod, and you can follow the blog over at backintimepod.com. JD, let's dive in to last week. We had a fun time discussing, you know, one of our favorite horror movies ever. We had a guest on, Dave and Jenny from Dave's Pop Culture Podcast, and we broke down House of a Thousand Corpses. What was your feedback on our House of a Thousand Corpses episode?
I think that, well, first of all, big thank you to Dave and Jenny for joining us. They're awesome guests as always, and I couldn't think of anybody better to be on the show with us. And the feedback that I got was really good and positive, and I think that there's more that we can say if we almost go down like a true crime serial killer tangent one time. I think that from what I heard, people liked a lot of what we touched and talked about. So a big thank you to our guests. A thank you to you. I don't thank you enough, Kyle, because for those of you that don't know, maybe if you're a new listener, all thanks and props go to Kyle because he's the one that sets up and edits and does all the magic to make this podcast come out. I just sort of show up.
That's literally the nicest thing you've ever said to me.
Yeah, well, you're a fart nugget.
Okay, there we go. Back to normal. It's good while it lasted.
That's what she said.
There we go. I was waiting for it. All right, I love it. Yeah, thanks so much for Dave and Jenny coming on, and they're going to be back. Jenny's been on for Keanu Reeves, top five. Dave's been on for 10 different episodes by now, so they'll be back, but yeah, check them out over at Dave's Pop Culture Podcast and give them a listen. Now, let's get to the reason we're here. Friday the 13th. This is a 1981, part two, I should say. It's a 1981 American slasher film produced and directed by Steve Miner in his directorial debut, written by Ron Kurz and starring Amy Steele, John Foray. And the film also features the return of Adrian King, Betsy Palmer, and Walt Gourney, who respectively portrayed Alice Hardy, Pamela Voorhees, and Crazy Ralph in the prior installment. It is the second installment in the Friday the 13th film series and a direct sequel to Friday the 13th from 1980 in our archives 1 year later. The movie picks up 5 years later, where a new murderer begins stalking the camp counselors at a nearby training camp on Crystal Lake. Now, JD, I know in the beginning we kind of, the teaser trailer episode, we talked about our first memories. Now, when you're watching this thing back for the first time, did you realize that this was only a year later and not actually 5 years later, like the movie portrays it? Because that kind of threw me off a little bit.
Yeah, it caught me off guard too. Even in rewatching it this time around, I was kind of like, wait a second, are we 1 year? Are we 5 years? What year is it? Where am I? I can't see.
Yeah, I started watching and I was like, God, was the first one in 76? Wow. Like, I had to really think about it and then get on IMDb and I'm like, no, it was last year. Okay. Huh.
Yeah, I definitely did the math too and was confused.
Yeah, we're not great with math, people. So that, I mean, you want to confuse us, throw a couple of math problems our way. It's an easy way to do
it. That's right.
We're going to talk about this more in the episode, but what did you think about just, I mean, it's kind of a change in the directing helm. It's a different writer. How do you feel like this kind of stacks up to the original?
So it's this, comparing it to the original is kind of a unique task, because the original was set up to be this own island of horror where you have Mrs. Voorhees as the killer, and to bring everything back and to call it 5 years later, but to piggyback off of what was established in the original creates a unique mythology and lore while also setting forth a franchise. Like, in my opinion, this is what really sets the franchise forward. So in that regard, it's probably and possibly better than the first one, but it can't match the twist ending of the original.
Okay. I like that. Now there is a little, not controversy, but just, you know, something to kind of talk about here. The filming took place from October 3rd, finished in November of 1980. So not a real long shoot here. Special effects artist Tom Savini was asked to work on the film, but had to decline because he was already working on another project called Midnight. And then also he was not receptive to the concept of Jason as the killer in the film. He was replaced by Stan Winston. Now, what do you think about that, JD? Because he's a pretty big part of the part one here, Tom Savini, with the makeup and special effects of, you know, the little boy in the water.
But yeah, I think that there's a lot to that gets lost in translation between Savini and who we have in the sequel here. I mean, Savini's a legend. He's him. I mean, he's effing great. So I don't want to say any disrespect to who we got to do the effects in this one. Thankfully, it wasn't Gustav Sinha. But regardless, I think that practically it turns out pretty decent in this film. There's some parts that I definitely did laugh at, and I don't think the makeup and the ending is as good this time around.
Okay. Well, no spoilers. We will get to that here. Now, let's take a quick break. We'll be back on the other side, and we will have the full review for Friday the 13th, Part 2. Talk to you in a minute.
Hey, this is Phantom Dark Dave, and I'm the host of Dave's Pop Culture Podcast. Right now, you're listening to the Back in Time Podcast, which features Kyle and JD, who have both been on my podcast. So if you're listening here, you need to listen to them there, and come check me out. Got everything from horror, science fiction, comic books and cartoons, and some outstanding comedy if you just like shooting the breeze. You can find me over on iTunes, Spotify, Podbean, and Google Play.
All right, we are back and ready to dive into the full episode here. So we begin with a little kid singing the Itsy Bitsy Spider, and he's walking down this puddle-filled road. His mother tells him to get in the house right away, and then the score intensifies, and we see some feet, and it's just this figure, and we pan out to see the house. Inside, we've got Alice, who lays on the bed, and she's having a nightmare. And we get, you know, a bunch of flashback scenes here with Mrs. Voorhees from the original film in our archives. Mrs. Voorhees yelling at Alice, "Look what you did to him! Look what you did to him!" And she attacks Alice, and she's able to flee from the room and then go outside and finds all of her friends' dead bodies. And then, of course, we end up in the boat after Alice was able to fend off Mrs. Voorhees. And then she chops her head clean off. And I like this. I actually thought this was a really cool recap. JD, what do you think?
It's a cool recap, that's for sure, but it's a little long in my book, considering this film has an 86-minute runtime. We lose an eighth of the film to this recap, and then the credit scene, which is monstrously long.
It's a little long in the tooth. Yeah, I think so. Let's keep chugging along. So Alice wakes up from her nightmare, goes into the bathroom to wash her face. And let's listen to our first clip when the phone rings.
Hello? Hi, Mom. I know, I'm sorry. I meant to call earlier, but I fell asleep. Really, I'm fine. I need a little time alone, that's all. I know you and Dad worry. I appreciate that. Come on, Mom. We've been through all of this before. I just have to put my life back together, and this is the only way I know how. Look, Mom, please. It's getting late, and I really don't want to get into it. I'll call you tomorrow. Bye.
JD, from a writing standpoint, what'd you like about this setup here?
It's a simple setup. It's something that's been overdone in years since 1981. But considering that it is 1981, we can have these little cheap moments where who's on the other line? She doesn't have caller ID. Oh, it's her mom. You know, the phone plays a factor in the next couple of minutes as well. And we have some more great jump scares. So anytime you can cut the silence with a steak knife instead of a bread knife, it's a win.
I like to cut my steak with a butter knife.
Well, you shouldn't.
Insert laugh track. I got nothing. Now Alice moves to the shower next. The phone rings again, and this time when she answers, dead silence. Alice immediately thinks something is up, and she goes to look out the window. She grabs a screwdriver and kind of like walks around the house checking things. Eventually she gets spooked by a cat who comes jumping through the window, and then Alice opens up the fridge to find a severed head, and then she's grabbed from behind the neck and a screwdriver is driven right through her temple. Well, JD, Alice won't be back for part three, but what'd you think of her death scene here in part two?
I appreciate this scene by tying up loose ends from the first one and creating a new segment in which we get to see Alice go. Mm-hmm. The head in the refrigerator again for 1981 probably caught a lot of people off guard. And then just the quick kill of the screwdriver to the skull was definitely rewarding.
Earlier, you talked about how you thought the recap was a little long in the tooth. This opening title screen, good Lord. I thought it was honestly the end of the movie. I'm like, oh, was this just a short in part two? Because that blank black screen with every single name that has anything to do with this movie goes on for about a good 4.5 minutes here. So we're about 10 minutes in before we actually get into our new cast. Any comments on that opening screen? Did you like that? Did you hate it?
I personally loved the explosion for part two. Outside of that, it was just kind of like, come on, come on, come on, come on. And then,
no kidding. They did what they could in the 80s.
Yes, they did.
Jeez. Now we cut to a truck and we meet some of our new cast. And we also get some of the old cast here. Crazy Ralph on his bike. Jeff and Sandra run over to the payphone to get directions to the house, and Crazy Ralph comes over and says, I told the others, but they wouldn't believe me. You're all doomed. You're all doomed. Crazy Ralph just takes off on his bike, and then Sandra yells, oh, shit, they're towing us. So they run over and try to stop the tow truck driver, who doesn't listen. He just keeps on driving. But as they get down to the end of the road, they find out this is all a prank from their friend Stu. JD, never trust a redhead. What'd you think of this?
Dude, never trust a redhead. Those gingers got no soul.
That's what I'm saying. We only know one. I mean, I want to say what movie he's in because people might look it up, but not good. Stephen Schwartz.
Not good.
May the Schwartz be
not
with you.
Not good. But no, it is cool, the callbacks to the first one that we get to see, and, you know, the prank, the false red herring, if you will, about the tow truck taking the car away.
I like your pun. All right, cool.
Wink.
So the three of them jump in the truck and head to the campground next. Stu mentions that they will be lucky if they make it out alive. Sandra is a little spooked by that, but kind of drops the conversation. They come up on a big tree branch and get out to move it, and then Sandra wanders off into the wooded area and finds the Camp Crystal Lake sign. Stu says, weird, that's where we're headed. And we can see they're being watched by someone lurking in the woods. Now, at the camp, we get our first shot of Terry. How do we describe Terry here? So she's wearing a cut-off Mickey Mouse t-shirt, some super short shorts, and then the camera is just zoomed in directly on her butt. And then she gets shot in the backside, in the rear end, with a pebble in a slingshot. And then the guy just comes out and says nothing and just kind of like smirks. And that's it. JD, what'd you think of this?
This is a good old school classic 80s villain move. I like from a writing standpoint, or at least from a direction standpoint, how they sort of mix and intermingle the moments where is this the villain Jason Voorhees stalking? Is it someone else just peeping? And it turns out we just got this creepy peeper who's just slingshotting girls in the bottom.
That, I guess that's a thing in 1981. Definitely wouldn't fly today. Can't do that. Nope. Now, if you, a little side note here, I texted JD earlier and said I reached out to a guest. This is who I reached out for to try and get on the podcast. So if you guys want to hear Kirsten Baker on our podcast, go ahead and tag her on Instagram, KirstenBaker13, and let her know she should be on the Back in Time podcast. That'd be a cool guest, I think. Have somebody actually from the movie that was on set, or tag somebody else that maybe you want to hear somebody else. I kind of picked her for some obvious reasons. Now, let's.
I wonder why.
I like Mickey Mouse. Let's listen to another clip where Paul is addressing the staff.
Okay, let's settle down. It's great to have you all here at our new counselor training center. You've all worked as counselors at one camp or other. Terry, Vicky, you two were upstate last summer, right? Scott, hi, good to see you here, buddy. You need it. And Mark, I know we worked a season or two together, right? Okay, the rest of you, I'm sure I'll get to know soon enough. I'm also sure there's one thing I don't have to tell any of you. Being a counselor isn't the gravy summer job everybody thinks it is. And what we're going to do over the next 2 weeks, if the rest of my staff ever shows up, is go back to basics. Survival, first aid, boating, archery, rifle range, all of them.
Jenny, who is the co-lead counselor, finally arrives and says she's late. Paul takes her into one of the cabins to kind of scold her, but she's like, it was just my car, and I tried the call, but the phones aren't on here. And then she apologizes and says she promises she'll never be late again and kisses him and then heads out to move her car and get things out of there. JD, it's kind of I don't know how to describe this scene. I mean, Paul's kind of addressing the staff and Jenny shows up. What would you think of this? Fluff?
It's very fluff. It's rudimentary storytelling, which when you really break down this movie at the end of the day, and I ask you right now in all seriousness, Kyle, what's the plot line to this movie?
I have no idea yet. I'd have to really think about that. I don't know what the plot is.
I mean, camp counselors try to survive a murderous night. That's not a story. That's just a bunch of actions. Yeah. And so it's filled, as you say, with fluff like this, where we get this simplistic characterization. So we know now that Paul is in charge and the damsel in distress doesn't give a shit. Mm-hmm. Her car is ill.
Yeah, I guess if I had to categorize it, honestly, and I don't get me wrong, I actually am enjoying the movie because this is my first time watching Friday the 13th Part 2. But if I had to guess a plot, the producers want to cash in. That's probably the best way to put it, because it's rushed out a year later and no real story behind it. So, yeah, I don't know. Well, I guess we'll give our final thoughts at the end. We'll see how this thing kind of chugs along here. So let's listen to another clip here. We're going to see Paul telling the rest of the counselors here about Jason.
I don't want to scare anyone, but I'm going to give it to you straight about Jason. His body was never recovered from the lake after he drowned. And if you listen to the old timers in town, they'll tell you he's still out there. Some sort of demented creature. Surviving in the wilderness. Full grown by now. Stalking. Stealing what he needs. Living off
wild animals and vegetation. Some folks claim they've even seen them right in this area. The girl who survived that night at Camp Blood, that Friday the 13th, she claimed she saw it. She disappeared 2 months later. Vanished. Blood was everywhere. No one knows what happened to her. Legend has it that Jason saw his mother beheaded that night, that he took his revenge. A revenge that he'll continue to seek if anyone ever enters his wilderness again. And by now, I guess you all know, we're the first to return here. 5 years. 5 long years he's been dormant. But he's hungry. Jason's out there. Watching. Always on the prowl for intruders. Ready to kill. Ready to devour. Thirsty for young blood.
JD, I actually really love the campfire story and the scare at the end. What'd you think of this?
It's 1981. You have to compare this movie against any other movie that came out as a camp movie before and after it. The first time that you get this fire scare story with the fake tactic, which is emulated perfectly in Broken Lizard's Club Dread, which I love, with Machete Phil. You were supposed to laugh at that, Kyle.
Ha ha. Laugh track. Insert.
You have to insert that one of these
days.
I'm
going to get a real laugh track. It's, yeah, like a studio one.
And maybe one of these days you'll get a real laugh.
Eh, doubtful.
But in all seriousness, no. It's a nice little scene that offers a good cheap scare. Again, this is a popcorn flick at the end of the day in 1981, and this is just trying to bring your bow closer to your crotch popcorn.
Okay. We're back inside the house. Lots of filler going on here. People just kind of frolicking around and, hey, how are you? Oh, hey, kiss my dog, blah, blah, blah. Meanwhile, the figure is outside watching through the window. And then Jenny leaves and says that she will see them all in the morning. Sandra and Jeff are dancing, and she tells him that she just has to go see Camp Blood. He's like, no way. I'm not doing that. Plus, Paul says it's off limits. She just smiles and she's like, we'll see. The sexual innuendo that she put across there. Strange. We cut to Jenny getting a cheap scare from Paul next, and then some more kissing between the two. He tells her that he really did miss her, and he was actually worried that she didn't show up in time, that something might be wrong. And then we see the one who's been watching outside the house here was Crazy Ralph. But as he kind of points his head out from around the side of the tree and then turns his back, he actually gets strung up here by some type of string or shoelace, and no more Crazy Ralph. JD, what do you think about the death of Ralph?
It was unexpected, you know, because again, they play and manipulate on who is watching from the dark, the shadow looming, who does it belong to? And we have this back and forth of subverting expectations. Now we got, you know, Crazy Old Dog, and he gets his whistle whacked. But it just makes me think, does he die because he happens to be there? Is Jason killing him on purpose? Is Jason just bloodthirsty? Like, You have to have payoff for your kills. And from a writing standpoint, especially in 2019, you can't just sacrifice a character for the sake of death porn. I mean, okay. You can. Obviously, Midsommar is a great example of sacrificing off characters for kind of the hell of it and doing it in a crucial way. But for this, it just seems superfluous.
Okay. Well, speaking of whistle whack, Jenny wakes up the next morning and her mirror says, beware of bears. She just sits up, smiles, and lays back down. We cut to Terry, who's looking for her dog Muffin next. And she looks for the dog for about, I don't know, 6 seconds. And then someone yells, "Terry, lunch!" And she's like, "All right." And she just takes off. JD, if your dog was missing, would you give up that easy over a hot dog?
Well, here's the thing. If my dog were missing, my dog would be by the hot dogs.
That makes sense. Okay. A little effort here, people. Good Lord.
No, I was going to say, you're right, and you're cutting to the core of my ultimate issue with this film, in that everything is kind of without purpose and just sort of masturbated onto film.
Okay. I like that word. Sandra.
Thank you.
Sandra is trying to talk Jeff into Camp Blood again. This time she calls him a chicken shit and then literally just starts pulling his arm. And then they go walking down a path and they just kind of like, or I guess in Sandra's case, they bounce along the path. Jenny tells a joke back at the, I guess they're, what are they? Like, kind of, they're hanging out at the beach, right? Or I guess at the lake. But anyway.
Yeah, a little lake, little area.
Yeah, getting some, maybe some training in, a couple laps, a little swimming. But I thought this was a decent joke from Jenny. She goes, "I got one. What's green and red and goes 1,000 miles an hour? A frog in a blender." I mean, come on, A for effort, right? It's not terrible.
What about the follow-up joke?
I didn't think it was as good.
It was a poop joke.
Yeah, I like the frog joke, though.
Okay, all right. Somebody likes killing frogs. Yeah. Potato penis.
Well, they gave me warts all the time when I was a kid. They got it coming.
I think that was your neighbor Ralph that was giving you those warts.
Ah, shit. Personal, man. Come on. So we're back to Sandra and Jeff. They're getting closer to Camp Blood, and we also see that they're being followed. They come up on this pathetic little wire fence with a tiny sign that says "No Trespassing," and they just,
and mind you, the "No Trespassing" sign is facing the camera, not them.
Right. Yep. Very well done by the filmmaker here. Damn it, some effort would be nice. JD, when they say they're close, like, I didn't think it was like a stone's throw away. I mean, they literally walk like a football field and they're like, "Well, I guess this is it." And then they find this little like garage sale sign that says "No Trespassing." And then he steps 1 foot over the little wire fence and they're there.
Yeah, it's one of those. It's a scene that is very popular throughout the 90s and the early 2000s in horror movies, to separate your main cast and to get them apart and to give them something to search after, in this case, Camp Blood, as they're calling it. Mm-hmm. So we have this trope of separating our characters, and in separation comes death, traditionally. But instead, what do we get?
We find a dog that's been mangled, and I'm fairly certain it's Muffin. And then they're caught by a police officer. So they get taken back to Paul's office, and the officer says, "Yeah, you guys are just too close. I mean, you know, basically he insinuates that maybe they should just leave and call it." He's like, "You know, we haven't had any issues here in 5 years. And then Paul kind of just dismisses the officer and doesn't reprimand Sandra or Jeff. And then jokingly, he tells Jenny that, "You know what? They're not getting seconds tonight for dessert." And the officer's just like, "I can't believe this." So he gets in his car and drives off. And then on his way out of the new campground, he sees a body kind of dive into the wooded area. He gets out. He gives chase. He stumbles upon this like shack in the middle of the woods. And it's pieced together. Doesn't look too sturdy, to be honest. And he goes through the house looking for this guy, and clearly someone lives there because it's got a toilet and, you know, because somebody's in there. And he opens up a door slowly, and then we see the figure sneak from behind and put a hammer right in the back of his head. So I guess for, you know, the things that they get wrong, I felt like they got this part right. This was kind of cool.
See, I disagree with you, because I'm just going to intersect and say, what is the point of this scene? What is the point? And two, okay, what the hell is Jason doing? Is he just sort of hiding behind a tree? Like, maybe a car's going to drive by soon and I'll run by really quick in front of it and it'll chase me. Like, how does he have any knowledge of the action that is going to occur leading him to kill this cop? And then why does he kill this cop? And really, why is the cop plays no presence at all? Like, he's just a pointless character to throw away. The death scene's really cool. I think the chase scene takes way too long. We're watching this guy. He takes a few strides and then he then he strides a little bit more. And then he finally somehow manages to make it to this encampment, which he's never seen before. And this is an area that he patrols extensively. Finds this encampment. And then we do get a little gem of a cool scene of him investigating. And then getting a hammer to the head for his efforts.
Well, I think as far as like the storyline goes, I'll disagree a little bit. Just because I do think like this is them or Jason getting this guy out of the way so he can't stop what he's going to do later. So he's eliminating a potential threat for what he wants to do.
Yeah, but you have to think, you have to make your villains intelligent, and you have to think that they have some sort of purpose to what they're doing. And so his best case scenario is, I'm going to leap in front of this car, then sprint off into the woods, knowing that the cop's going to follow me.
Okay, okay. Did you not see his craftsmanship on that house? I mean, not intelligent? I mean, come on. Take some brains to build that check.
I get what you're saying. If he's intellectually eliminating the cop for the reason of getting closer to the kids to kill them, I'm just saying it's a really, 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 really lousy plan.
Okay, get what you're saying. Let's keep chugging along. So Paul announces they're going to have one more night on the town. He volunteers Sandra and Jeff to stay behind. Little punishment there. And then Terry and Scott say that they will stay behind as well. Mark, the guy in the wheelchair, and a few others are going to stay too. And then Terry says she's going for a walk. JD, could there be a worse idea in a horror movie than the hot girl going for a walk in the middle of the night, pitch black?
Yeah, there is a worse decision that she can make, and she does definitely make it, though.
Yes, that's coming here shortly. Terry is on her walk, and she's still wearing a different cutoff t-shirt, and she stops at the water and she's like, muffin, nope, not here. I'll go ahead and strip and skinny dip. It just doesn't feel like it's going to end well for Terry here, but I do enjoy the scene. Now we cut back to Mark and Jeff arm wrestling. Mark wins pretty easily. And then Sandra comes down and tells Jeff not to wear himself out. And if you want to wrestle, come with me. JD, there's a lot of nudity and sex happening right now in this movie. What'd you think?
We get to the nitty-gritty of what an 80s sleepaway camp, in quotes, movie is all about. And that's the sex, the drugs, and the rocking and cocking.
So we cut back to Terry, who is swimming in the water. We see an arm reach down and pick up her clothes. And then when she swims out of the lake and notices her clothes are gone, Creepy Scott pops out and says, looking for something? He keeps the shirt from her, so she chases after him with nothing but a towel on and a pair of shorts. And she tells him this is no longer funny. And Scott steps right into a rope trap here and gets strung up by his feet. She says, I'm just going to let you hang here, you pervert. She leaves and says, don't go anywhere. And she runs back to the house to grab something to cut him down with. And then we cut back to Scott, who's just hanging, and he gets grabbed by the back of the head, and a huge machete knife just slices across his throat. JD, no more creepy Scott. What'd you think of this death scene?
I have to wonder, is this a trap planted by Jason?
I would assume so.
But again, this goes into my whole complaint of how lazily he's just being like, hey, let me just throw down trap A, B, and C and hope for the best that somebody falls into it. Like, how could he know that Creepy Scott is going to back into the noose at this moment for him to come and machete him to death?
Very convenient. Terry returns back to find the now dead Scott. And she lets out a really great scream here. I have to give her that. And then we're at the bar with the rest of the crew. Stu is hitting on the bartender. And they're talking about what he would be like if he were around today, talking about Jason. Jenny says that he would be grown now. And really the only person he was ever around was his mother. And she said he must have seen his mother get killed. And, you know, wasn't that what this was all about? His mother's revenge? So, you know, he must be out there now.
It's a lot of dialogue here from Jenny. JD, but what'd you think of this?
I kind of like this scene because of the change of pace that it gives to the rest of the story. I mean, we've seen so much of the characters in the camp and around the fire and in the cantina. And so now to take them away, but we know they're out of the way of harm, and to get some sort of little bit of development for the first time, I think is interesting.
Back at the house, Jeff and Sandra are about to take a trip to the bedroom, and we also find out downstairs that Mark was in a motorcycle accident. And that's why he's wheelchair-bound and he's paralyzed from the waist down. No pun intended here, but we smash back to Sandra and Jeff, who are getting it on in the bedroom. And then back downstairs, Vicky just straight up asked Mark, "Hey, do you want to stay the night together?" And he's like, "Yeah, I was about to ask you the same thing." JD, to say this is every guy's dream would probably be the understatement of the century, would it not?
Yes, but you're skipping out on the fact where she asks him, "So is everything paralyzed?"
Yeah, that's yep. Good point by you.
It's apparently a winner, it's of a line.
He's just like, "Nah, I get around.
All right. I can make do. I think he says, "I do all right."
Okay. I like his confidence. Probably doesn't, though. Let's be honest. No legs. Not good. Vicky goes to her car to grab something, and when she opens the door and bends down, we hear some thunder and lightning, and we think that's going to be the end of Vicky. But we cut back to the house, and Mark wheels himself out onto the porch. He calls for Vicky, and he has his back to the stairs the entire time, and the camera slowly kind of focuses on the back of his head. I'm like, oh boy, here we go. Knife to the back of the head. No, the knife gets him right in the face and then pushes him down a hill in his wheelchair. That's it for Mark. JD, what'd you think of this?
Probably one of the most fantastic death scenes outside of Mac and Me. The way that his wheelchair just sort of like goes down the steps. And then even like the machete to the face, and he goes, "Ah!" Without moving his lips. I love it.
Uh-huh. Yep, just some straight-up terrible slasher. I love it. Sandra and Jeff have finished up what they're doing in the bedroom when we see the figure enter the house and head into the room where Sandra and Jeff are, and we see the figure enter, and then Jeff takes, like, a tribal-looking weapon right through his body all the way to the floor. Then we cut back to the house and we see Vicky actually survived from outside. She comes in looking for Mark, but of course he's nowhere to be found. So she heads upstairs because where else would a paraplegic go but up the stairs? That makes sense. And she enters Sandra and Jeff's room to see the two are under a white sheet. So she kind of peels back the sheet a little bit, but it's not Jeff. It's a undertaking-looking figure here that just sits straight up, knifes her, and then we see him kind of slowly approach with the knife. It's kind of a weird camera angle. I see what they were going for. But, JD, the deaths are coming fast and furious. What do you think of this one?
Yeah, the knife scene is kind of... She had a lot of time to run, so it's kind of almost unbelievable. I feel like... This part is a little kind of unbelievable, but it does take some cues from Halloween. Do you not get like a big Michael Myers vibe from this scene?
For sure. Yeah, definitely. It's a different variation of that, which I really like. I think it works. You can't really like follow the knife too long. Like, it's a little cheesy when you do that. Like, she should have at least put up a little fight for her life, should she? Or just you just stand there and you're like, "Well, this is it."
Yeah, it's do you want some cheddar or some Gouda?
Right to the food.
Well, you said cheese.
You're hungry, aren't you? Yeah. Here we go. Let's get to the nitty-gritty here. Jenny and Paul arrive back at the house. We see a body being dragged down the stairs. And then Jenny and Paul immediately think something's up. So they head upstairs and we hear Jenny yell for Paul. And they find the bloody bed, no bodies though. And now the lights have been cut to the entire house. So Paul grabs a flashlight, they head downstairs. And as they're looking for lights to turn on, Paul is attacked and he's donning the figure a white pillowcase with eyes cut out, and it kind of looks like it's the end for Paul here. Jenny plays a little cat and mouse with the figure as she kind of goes from room to room, and then finally manages to kind of lock herself into this back room. We see the door handle twitching, trying to get open, and then a pitchfork comes through the door, and Jenny flees through the window to the car outside. But of course, wouldn't be a horror movie without the car not starting. So we see the figure appear by the window, and then it just kind of ducks down and disappears. And then we see some jabbing of the pitchfork through the top of the car. Jenny manages to flee again, and this time she runs into the woods and hides long enough where she can kind of hide behind this brush area, and she hears the figure approaching, so she jumps out and kicks him in the nards. Who would have thought, man? Pillowhead's got nards, man. Now, she hides and then takes off into the woods again, and when she gets to the clear, he catches up really quickly, but she outsmarts him again, hides behind a tree. We have a lot of hiding and running here, I'm not going to lie. We have some cutaway shots of the moon, and then each of the two just kind of running. And then we cut to a house, not sure which one it is quite yet. And we see the figure's feet kind of walking around, and Jenny is tucked underneath a bed. But he doesn't see her. And then a mouse approaches her, which causes her to piss herself. He sees the pee on the ground.
Why does she piss herself?
It's just a mouse. Like, relax with the pee. I don't get it. Yeah, that made no sense to me, but that was a dead giveaway. So she crawls out from under the bed, but he's standing on a chair that collapses on her. So he completely whiffs. And I mean, this could be almost like a comedy at this point.
It's like an episode of Three Stooges.
It's very Stooge-like. Jenny runs over and grabs the chainsaw and appears to kind of saw him in the arm here, and then breaks the chair over the top of him. And she leaves the house, heads back to the woods again. I mean, gosh dang it, is she not in some crazy shape? Because she's running all over the place and does not seem to be one bit tired. And then in the woods, she enters this terrible-looking shack. And she's like, oh, there's somebody that'll help me. She finds the sweater from Jason's mother. And let's take a listen to the clip here. She's finally put two and two together.
Jason, mother is talking to you!
Jason, mother is talking to you.
Come.
Come. That's my boy. Come. Kneel down. That's a boy.
To digest here, the scene ending with Jenny taking out Jason with the help from Paul. What did you think of this?
I'm kind of, I don't know, I've got mixed feelings about her being like, hey, let me put on this dirty sweater. I don't know that I would have thought of that as a strategy. I thought she was going to pick up the head and like hold it in front of her and be like, oogie boogie boogie. But no, she puts on the sweater and that's enough to get Jason to his knees. I just don't.
I actually thought she was going to wear the face.
I don't see or understand the mythology behind what they're establishing as a weak chink in the link of Jason.
Yeah, I didn't get it either. Were you surprised at all that Paul actually survived here?
Oh yeah, I thought he was dead. So it was welcome to see him come back.
Good old Paul. I got nothing against Paul. I like seeing him survive. So Jenny takes off the mask and they look at him and Paul's just like, oh, Jesus. So they leave the shack and head back to the house. Paul carries her all the way back and we think this might be all over. The music has kind of changed the tone, but then they hear something stirring. Paul hands Jenny the pitchfork, and he goes over to the door. The music intensifies, and he reaches for the handle. But when he opens up the door, it's Muffin. Muffin's safe and sound, after all. I thought Muffin was dead, too. So Paul swoops up the dog, and Jenny stands up, and that's when Jason comes bursting through the window, grabs Jenny from behind, and he's all mangled. He's got the knife sticking out of his back. I gotta admit, this actually got me a little bit. I was expecting it, and it still was like, oh, there it is. What'd you think?
No, I'm with you. I laughed at how many times they said Muffin. Muffin. Oh, Muffin. Oh, Muffin. It's Muffin. I was like, okay, we get it. It's the dog. And then it lulls you to sleep, and then...
It did not get you on the scare, I would have to assume.
No, because it plays off the same trope that the original set up, that you're waiting for this last minute something from nowhere, which I think is a success because it worked on you. It did its job.
Very true. It did work. Now, with that being said, it would never get me again, but it did get me once. We would think that this might be it. It's kind of a good way to end it, we would think. But we wake up, it's the next day now, and Jenny is being loaded up into the back of an ambulance. She's like, where's Paul? And then we cut back to Jason's shack, and we just see that severed head sitting on the table, and the screen just pauses and the credits roll. So obviously setting up for more sequels to come. What did you think of the ending here, JD?
I'm torn because, as I've said earlier, I don't think that this film really is successful in telling any little bit of a story at all. But it does a great job of setting up subsequent sequels. So, yes, as we close out this film, I can't help but ask, what happens in part three? And I can't help but be excited to find out.
Are you excited, though? Are you?
Yes, because we've sat through now two movies about the infamous Jason Voorhees, and we have not once seen him with his trademark mask on.
Okay, that's a good talking point right there. Are you a fan of the mask?
I think that what he wears in number two is a lot more menacing than just a hockey mask. But obviously he's most well known for what he wears in the next seven films, eight films.
Made famous by Clark W. Griswold.
Vroom, vroom.
Bend over and I'll show you. Gosh, great movie. I cannot wait till we get
to that. It's happening.
Coming in December, folks. Stay tuned. And I did say folks because he says that a lot in the movie. See my tie-in? Now, JD, how has this movie held up over the years? Hard to believe it's as old as it is, this old bag of bones. What'd you think?
Again, I think that on its own, this movie kind of sucks. I have to say it. I just have to say it. Like,
say it like it is.
The story, it doesn't have the impact that the original does, as an original tells a unique tale. Whereas this one is just sort of essentially machete bait. But it does set up one of the longest standing franchises, and I'm super excited and love what it accomplishes.
Okay. I'll buy that for a dollar. I'll buy that for a blumpkin,
yeah, well,
as you like to say. All right. Well, that'll wrap it up for this week's episode. Friday the 13th, part two. Had a lot of fun. Hope you guys enjoyed it as well. We will be back next week. Actually, a couple short announcements. So we were able to figure out the recording. So you guys are going to get a in-depth look into the party that we had at JD's place for Halloween. So that's going to come out, I would say, later this week. So if you're listening to this on Wednesday or Thursday, be on the lookout for that episode to drop on Friday. on Monday or Tuesday, we're going to drop our review of Zombieland Double Tap. And we'll do a little review of the first one. Not going to be our scene-by-scene breakdown that we normally do, but that'll kind of be a two-for-one special there. And then the following week, we're back with Saw 3. It wouldn't be Halloween if we didn't do a Saw movie. Luckily, we've got about 10 years worth, so we're good.
We have to do Saw. It has to happen.
It has to happen. So that's what's coming down the pipeline here. Thanks again for hitting the download button. As always, you guys can subscribe to the show on Apple Podcast, Google Play. We're on Spotify, CastBox, IGTV, YouTube. You can follow us on social media at Back in Time Pod. I'm at KAutry29. JD is at Unjust Justin. And for now, we are out of time. Time to get back into the DeLorean, punch in today's date, and head back to present day. Thanks for listening. See ya.
That's Jason pooping.